Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nyman Show. Today is Monday, December 12th, 2016. There's been quite a bit happening in Zika. The Florida's restriction zones have all been lifted, but in Texas, they've been having some local transmission. I believe they're up to 5 cases now. And Dr. Nyman will also be talking about the sequences for what's been going on with that. He's been studying that over about the past week or so with the H5N6, and we'll be talking about how that has been evolving and some of the latest on the H5N8. So for all of this and more, Dr. Nyman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ryan. It's good to be back. And, I thought it'd be worthwhile to play a little bit of catch-up. You know, as you mentioned, there's been development in all three of these areas, which we really haven't covered the latest. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I just want to kind of highlight the important points, and maybe we can do a follow-up a little bit later on that. But to begin with, the Zika, as you noted, things are winding down in Florida. That basically last week they only had 5 local cases, and they actually were cases that had developed symptoms a while ago and had just been confirmed. And so they reached 45 days in Miami Beach without new cases, and as a result they lifted that restriction. That restriction, if you recall, was really 2 areas. First it was South Beach, and then it was the Mid Beach. It was kind of fused together, so the size got to be fairly large. They kind of changed the definitions. Just as a brief reminder, you know, the concern is really on the local transmissions, because the local transmissions indicate that local mosquitoes are infected with Zika, and therefore anyone who visits the area can develop Zika simply by exposure to mosquitoes. Usually the U.S. Puts much broader bans in. Generally, if there's local transmission and they've got multiple cases, they'll put the entire country on the list as a warning, especially for pregnant women, because they run the risk of getting infected with Zika, which can damage fetus and pregnant women. Microcephaly has been associated with infections in the first trimester or the beginning of second trimester. But there's some evidence that there are additional problems even when infections happen in later in the term. So the concern is largely for pregnant women, and instead of issuing a notice for the whole country, the CDC targeted not just all of Florida, but and not just all of Miami, but areas where there was active transmission. And it was a little bit unusual on how they kind of modified these definitions as to where the warning zone would be. Generally, the local transmissions, they essentially require some analysis of the affected person to ensure that, A, they didn't travel outside of the area, at least in the few weeks prior to developing symptoms, and also they generally do interviews to rule out the possibility that that the person got affected through sexual contact with somebody who had traveled outside of the area. Generally, if they can rule out sexual contact and travel, that indicates it's a local case. And like I said, frequently, the multiple local cases is enough to institute a ban. In this case, they took it a step further, which was not just to to localize it to a given state or even a certain county. They actually were looking to localize it to individual neighborhoods. And basically all that's really required to identify it in a neighborhood is to have two cases within a 1 square mile area is essentially what the CDC had used in the past to identify the localized area. And so it wasn't enough, at least as far as the Florida Department of Health was concerned, to just say that they had multiple local cases in Miami-Dade County, for instance, where it says in most cases. But they went further by not really giving information where these cases were in Miami-Dade. And the argument against giving the location of the, at least the residence of the individual is they weren't sure if that individual got infected in or near the home or if they had traveled somewhere in the state or in most cases within the county or even some cases within the city. Without having a second case, they couldn't really identify the area. They were able to do that in the Wynwood area, which was the initial cluster that was identified, and then there was a restriction on that. When they identified Wynwood, they actually had multiple cases. They really had clusters of clusters. They had two people that worked within a few blocks of each other, and in both instances, there was evidence that they were each parts of clusters which shared location for work, and so they had two work environments that were close to each other, and so they really had multiple cases in the same area. After that, though, they seemed to change the definition from just two cases in an area, which would at least help define where this local transmission was happening. They withheld that information, and instead they didn't give out the information until they reached five cases. And then when they had five, then they put up a restriction zone, and the CDC issued a warning saying that pregnant women should avoid going into that area. They also broadened it a bit, acknowledging that, for instance, Miami-Dade, there have been lots of cases, and so local cases. And so it wasn't just the one neighborhood. They kind of warned that there were lots of cases, and it was likely that the mosquitoes were not limited to that one area. They made it very difficult to identify exactly where these outbreaks were happening within a given county. And so there were a limited number that were identified. There were really four different areas that were identified in Miami-Dade County that all had at least five local cases within a 1 square mile area. Two of them were in Miami Beach and adjacent to each other. And there was the Wynwood one, and then there was one just north of Wynwood or just west of Miami Beach. So all four areas that were identified were in a fairly small region of Miami, and because there hasn't been any cases in any of those areas in the last 45 days, on Friday they kind of lifted the ban, and now they really don't have any warning for pregnant women not to go, but they still include Miami-Dade, for instance, as an area that you might think about avoiding, especially if you're pregnant. But at about the same time that things were winding down in Florida, things were picking up in Texas. Brownsville, Texas had the first case a couple of weeks ago. This, again, was a local case, and then just on Friday, there were four more cases that were identified through screening. And it's useful to kind of compare the two different methodologies as far as finding additional cases. For Miami, the screening, at least for the initial case, involved going door to door and collecting urine samples. And in doing that, they identified six cases, and all six of these individuals that were Zika positive on a urine test were actually asymptomatic. And so they were pretty aggressive about finding cases near where these confirmed cases were. And they were successful at doing that. In contrast, what Texas appears to have done based upon their press releases is that once they had identified a local case, they went around door to door, but they didn't collect urine samples. They basically handed out literature, and they warned people how to avoid objects that had standing water, which were breeding grounds for mosquitoes. So they tried to limit the mosquito population by denying them places to lay eggs, for instance. And then they also apparently told these people that if they developed flu-like symptoms or symptoms compatible with Zika, that they should give them a call, they'll come by and collect the urine sample and give them a test. And that did result in four positives. But the test, the press release noted that all four of these cases were symptomatic. And so the level in Brownsville is probably quite a bit higher than the index case plus the four people that lived relative within a six-block area is how it was defined. Because they were doing the urine sample and they were only testing symptomatic cases, so they would only be testing those who had symptoms. And it's the general rule of thumb is that only about 20% of the Zika cases develop symptoms. So if they had four that were symptomatic and positive, then they probably had another 15 to 20 that were asymptomatic and positive. And that would be a lot of people within a small area. And in fact, just testing urine samples would have created a rather large number of cases. Apparently, the testing is still ongoing, so the 1 plus 4 may increase. But if they did a survey as was done in Florida, they would probably come up with quite a few more. Florida had limitations also. Since they were doing a urine test for PCR, they were only testing people that had been infected within a couple of weeks of actually providing the sample. And so that testing would miss those that had been infected a month or two prior to the detection of the PCR positive cases that led to clusters. So that's kind of where things stand. Brownsville is likely to produce more cases, and the ongoing local transmission is probably quite a bit higher than the five symptomatic cases that have been positive. And so we'll keep an eye out for that. There does seem to be an increase in travel-related cases in Cameron County, which is where Brownsville is located. It's right at the border with Mexico. And adjacent Hidalgo County also has seen an increase in travel-related. So there appears to be active transmission probably in Mexico, and some of these travel-related cases probably are to Mexico, because both of these counties are very, very close to the Mexican border. And generally, these travel cases are somewhat dependent upon geography in Florida. The sequences, anyway, suggest that those the imported cases would have come from the Caribbean, and Dominican Republic in particular is where there seems to be a large number of cases that have sequences that are closely related. And so it's likely that the numbers will continue to go up in Brownsville. And And this is really just about the time of year that things started to take off in the United States from the travel-related cases, if you recall. A lot of those initial cases happened right after Christmas break. Various people went down to Central or South America or the Caribbean over Christmas break, and then came back and started developing symptoms after they returned and they were tested. And so the positives in the U.S. started to go up in like February and March. Took a little while to actually get tested and then be reported, so there's a bit of a lag. But, you know, that's essentially where things stand on the Zika. So they're slowing down in Florida. They're going up in Brownsville, Texas. And it is getting cooler, so you know, it's unlikely that these cases are going to spread in the United States because it's winter, and most of the cases outside of you know, the extreme southern areas don't have active mosquitoes, and they're pretty much required to get the transmission of the Zika virus because they really are the source of the rapid spread, although it can't spread sexually. And so I think we're going to switch gears and kind of give a bit of an update on what's going on with both H5N6 and H5N8. H5N6, as readers might recall, is ongoing in at a poultry level in both Japan and South Korea. Recently, though, the China reported two human cases, and those sequences haven't been released, but a paper came out a week or two ago now and released a large number of H5N6 sequences from China. Most of these cases were collected towards the end of 2014, during 2015, or the beginning of 2016. And they greatly increased the number of H5N6 cases, sequences that were public, both in poultry as well as in humans. Those sequences were just released at GSAD. There had been some sequences, but the number of human sequences essentially doubled, and it provided some insight as to what's going on in the H5N6 virus. There were three human cases in 2014. Then there was another 8 to 10 in 2015, and then other than the two recent ones, there was another 5 at the beginning of 2016. And these are all the same Fujian strain. The H5 is from Fujian, going back to the 2005 in Fujian province. That was called 22.3. And then the versions get additional numbers. So this was actually 2.3.4.4. And this virus has spread pretty dramatically. Just as a reminder, the influenza is a segmented genome, so it's got 8 pieces of RNA that can kind of act like chromosomes, and if the same host is infected with 2 different viruses, they can reassort, shuffle these genes and produce a new virus that as some of the genes from one parent and some of the genes from the other. Those are called reassortants. And those are useful to determine the origin of the virus. The reassortment has given rise to a large number of serotypes. One of the points of this recent paper is that the H5N1 has been largely replaced with H5N6, and so the dominant serotype in China now is H5N6 instead of H5N1. The H5 is the same H5 as the same Fujian strain that's got the same designation, 2.3.4.4. And so that pretty much determines how the virus gets into the cell. And that virus was highly pathogenic, so in poultry anyway, it kills poultry very quickly, and that's due largely to the H5. And what had happened in China several years ago, it seemed that the H5N1 was doing a lot of this reassortment of shuffling the genes. And when N is one of the genes that gets shuffled, it can give rise to a different serotype. The serotype has to do with the antigenic properties of the H as well as the N. And if the H5N1 is in a host that's infected with another influenza virus with a different N, they can produce a new virus that's got the H5 from one parent and the N from another parent. And that indeed happened and gave rise to a large number of different serotypes. It was H5N1, H5N2, H5N3, H5N5, H5N8, H5N9. So that became very obvious that there was a lot of reassortment that was going on. And it became even clearer in 2014. There was an outbreak of H5N8 in Europe, and that really traced back to H5N8 that was circulating in Japan, which grew out of an H5N8 outbreak in South Korea. But then that H5N8 in Japan, there were really three different versions of it, ended up causing major outbreaks both in North America as well as in Taiwan. And those gave rise to different serotypes. In Taiwan, there was not just the H5N8, but there was also H5N2 and H5N3. And in North America, it was not just the H5N8, but there was H5N2 and H5N1. And it was useful to look at those sequences and see that not only did the assortment produce multiple serotypes, but it was easy to identify the origin of the different gene segments. And what that indicated was that there was quite a bit of reassortment going on beyond just the several of the internal genes came from wild birds that were local, so that the H5N2 and the H5N3 in Taiwan were from had gene segments that had been found in wild birds in Asia, whereas the H5N1 and the H5N2 in North America had internal genes, including the N's, which had come from wild birds in North America. And so looking at these gene segments was very useful in distinguishing the different serotypes and how they differed, as well as how they originated. And it was very clear from those sequences that they were originating from wild birds, and the wild birds were providing the new N, as well as several of the new internal genes. And so looking at the origins of these segments, it was very useful to look at the H5N6. The H5N6 was evidence that human cases was not limited to H5N1. The first human H5N6 case was in the spring of 2014, and then there were a couple more in 2014. And it was clear, therefore, that the H5 could cause human cases even if it wasn't paired up with N1. It could do it with N6. And this, those three sequences in 2014 indicated that there was a fair amount of variety. The H5, I mean, you can distinguish the H5s, even though they're all clade 2.3.4.4. There are different subdivisions within that, subclades within that group, and you could see that the H5 could, through phylogenetic analysis, could be distinguished from each other. And it indicated that the H5N6s, quite a few different H5N6s, could cause human disease. The number of cases increased in 2015, and there was one group of cases. There were five different sets of sequences now after these new ones were released from Yunnan province. And the sequence from Yunnan province provided some insight in that they were fairly closely related to each other. But they started to pick up internal genes that were a little bit different than the 2014, including several genes that were either from H9N2 or H7N9. If you recall, the H7N9 caused a lot of human cases in China. And it appeared that there were reassortments that involved H7N9 with H5N6, and that ended up producing constellations that had multiple genes, internal genes from H7N9. One of those genes was the PB2, and if you recall, PB2 is one of the polymerase genes. Those are the genes that copy the genetic information of the virus. And once human adaptation is to have a K position, 627, that allows the virus to grow at a lower temperature, which is more compatible with the body temperature of humans, which is 37 degrees centigrade, as opposed to birds, which is 41 degrees. The K change optimizes the enzyme that copies the genetic information to about 33 degrees. More compatible with, like a human nose in the wintertime exposed to the cold air. And at that colder temperature, the virus is able to copy its genetic information at a significantly higher rate. And indeed, a lot of these H5N6 cases in Yunnan province had the PV2 that had the K. So that was found in adaptation in human cases. And that may have contributed to the increase of the number of cases that would transmit to other humans more easily or to other mammals more easily, because at the lower temperature, the virus would replicate the upper respiratory tract and then be more easily transmitted through coughing or sneezing. And so that helped explain why there was an increase of cases in Yunnan province. And then the same thing was seen for China and Guangdong province in southern China. There were a number of cases at the end of 2015 in December, and again at the beginning of 2016 in January. And most of those sequences had that same property, that most of the internal genes were actually H7N9, including the PB2, which was not just H7N9, it was a human version with the K at position 67. And so it's possible that these reassortments involving internal genes that have been associated with human cases of H7N9 we're now giving rise to human cases of H5N6, at least in southern China. Now, the sequences from the two most recent cases, which were in December or November of 2016, have been released to see if those have those same properties, and they have these internal genes of H7N9. The H5N6 outbreaks in Southern Korea and South Korea, as well as Japan, don't have these H7N9 internal genes. And so there's some speculation that even though there's a lot of reassortment, it's now picking up these internal genes associated with H7N9. And therefore, that may limit the number of H5N6 human cases that happen in Japan and South Korea, neither of which have reported any cases to date. And those same differences may account for the fact that There haven't been any human cases of H5N8, even though the H5 is the same Fujian clade 2.3.4.4 that's seen in the H5N6 as well as the earlier H5N1 human cases. So that may account for an absence of the H5N8. Now, the H5N8, even though it hasn't produced any human cases, was fairly devastating in 2014, but really most of the devastation was in 2015 in both Taiwan as well as the United States. There were massive outbreaks in the U.S. and Minnesota, which is the number one turkey producer, as well as in Iowa, which is the number one egg producer. So it attacked both chickens as well as turkeys. And both of those really happened in the spring when the virus started flying back through the Midwest and giving rise to these very large number of outbreaks in both chicken and turkey farms. And now, this year, there really hasn't been anything in North America yet, and there's the H5N6 that I already mentioned in South Korea and Japan. But there's a massive outbreak of H5N8 in Europe, and it's actually not limited to Europe. It's in Europe, it's in the Middle East, and it's in Northern Africa already. And so this outbreak of H5N8 is actually larger than the outbreak of H5N1. Where that led to a global spread of H5N1 in 2005/2006. In 2005, in the fall, at least the confirmed cases was rather limited to really four countries in Europe. It initially showed up in Romania, then it was in Ukraine, then it was in Turkey, as well as Croatia. But that was really it. And then the massive number of reported confirmed cases increased dramatically in the spring of 2006. There were almost 50 countries that reported H5N1 for the first time in that time period when the birds were actually flying back again. And so exactly how big the spread is going to be in the spring of 2017 remains to be seen, but it's still going up pretty dramatically in 2016. And it's moved into the Middle East. There have been outbreaks in Israel, a limited number in Egypt so far, but there may be more coming. It's also been reported in Iraq. It's also been reported in the steppe region of Russia. So it's likely that it's going to show up in Azerbaijan and Georgia in the not too distant future. And it's also gone into North Africa. In addition to being in Egypt, it's been confirmed in Tunisia. And it's pretty widespread in Europe. Again, it comes down to the testing. Germany has had a lot of cases, a lot of wild bird cases in Switzerland. And then other countries have reported somewhat smaller numbers, although on poultry farms, there have been a lot reported in Hungary. There have been 60, 70 farms now that have been confirmed with H5N8 there. Again, it has to do, the reassortment really indicates that the origins really indicate it's from wild birds. There was an outbreak in southern Russia in the Tiber region, which is on this northern tip of Ouz Lake, which goes into Mongolia. There was a large outbreak there in the spring. Those sequences were released. Again, it was clade 2.3.4.4. But the genes were a little bit different than the earlier H5N8, so it's easy to distinguish. Actually, the H5 was a little bit closer to the H5N6 human cases, but it had a different set of internal genes. And then once it flew to Europe, sequences came out of Poland and Sweden, which indicated that the virus had changed a little bit since it was like five of the genes were really the same as the Ouz-like, but three of them actually involved other wild birds, including one of the gene segments, which was largely from wild bird sequences that had been found in Europe. And so, again, it's kind of the same scenario where there's additional reassortment. The reassortment involves local wild birds. This, you know, provides, you know, very conclusive evidence that this was brought by the wild birds that migrated in these regions in the fall. Europe has a fairly active group that tries to insist that this has to do with commercial farming. It's not due to the wild birds. It kind of invokes this, you know, wild birds as victims, and again, the wild birds just get affected by commingling with the poultry, and they also use the dead birds don't fly, indicating it's a very lethal virus, and therefore any wild birds that get affected don't really transmit it because they die fairly quickly. And, you know, both of those were thoroughly disproven back in 2005 from BH5N1. It's repeated multiple times, the same kind of louse in the same time period, and the sequences, you know, including these reassortments where the virus that shows up is not a virus that's been in a local farm. In fact, there are viruses that are found in wild birds, and they pick up new genes that are also found in wild birds. So these new constellations are found for the first time in the wild birds, and then after they fly into the area, eventually they show up in the farms, and the farms match the wild birds. It's not the wild birds matching the farms. And so that's kind of what the situation is for the H5N8. Like I say, there hasn't been anything in North America yet. It's very active in Europe, a little bit in the Middle East and North Africa, and in all likelihood. These will slow down a little bit as it starts getting colder, and then there'll probably be another massive spread of the virus come spring when the birds, when the wild birds start heading back north and then infect local birds as well as poultry on their way back. So that kind of wraps things up. It kind of brings listeners up to date on what's going on with Zika in the United States, as well as what's going with H5N6 and H5N8. There's other information, but, you know, I've already said quite a bit. There's a study that actually came out of Colombia with microcephaly and Zika cases. And so as it's been widely known to those paying attention that the microcephaly is related to the Zika virus. It's not related to Brazil, which is another one of these internet rumors that has been, you know, widely circulating. And Colombia has been used in the past as evidence that it's something to do with Brazil because they didn't have microcephaly. CDC came out with an MMWR last week that did show a fourfold increase in the number of the frequency of microcephaly cases in Colombia. And the timeline, the epi curve, you know, closely matched the expected in that it took 6 months after Zika arrived because microcephaly is not associated with pregnancy. The women infected in the second and third trimesters take 6 months before those infected in the first trimester start to give birth, and they started showing up in Colombia right on time with in accordance with when the Zika infection started there. And so there are a few odds and ends. We can cover those in later podcasts. But this one kind of brings things up to date on Zika in both H5N6 and H5N8.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Nyman, for the information. Listeners can always go to our website at commonomics.co for all the latest information, as it's always updated, including the ever-popular now H5N8 map. It's very, very popular and, like I said, very useful, and, again, it's updated all the time. So people would really find that useful of discovering where everything latest with H5N8 is. There's also an H5N6 map as well, which is also the same thing, continuously updated, as well as the popular Zika map. So we're always up to date on everything with the map, so listeners will find those very useful. So everyone, thank you and have a good day.